hockey's the hook, not the reason. Right. A lot of people think that maybe this foundation started so that we can develop hockey players for colleges, etc. Well, we are doing that, but that's not the reason for the foundation. The reason for the youth hockey program is education.
Every one of us is a walking museum of sports, from that first ball game, maybe with your family, to getting that nervous, sweaty autograph, to maybe even taking your own kids to their first game. It's the feeling you get that brings us all back to our own personal Philly field of dreams. And the Museum of Sports Show is on the air and ready to go there with you. I'm Doug Scheimel, our show dedicated to sports memories, memorabilia, and the museum that's going to capture it all right here in Philadelphia. We're live on the Talk 860 and Museum of Sports Facebook pages, so look us up. Museum of Sports Show brought to you by Depatche Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. Joining me as always from his sports bunker every week in Villanova, he is our guide and mentor, Comcast Spectacor legend, founder of the Museum of Sports, and author of the new book, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flash and Cash Rescued the Flyers and Created Philadelphia's Greatest Showplace. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Lou Scheinfeld. How you doing, Lou?
Well, the Phillies won last night. It was quite an event, the fact that they won. They're not doing so well, but so many big things in Philadelphia sports off the field. Ray Dittinger, my dear friend and colleague forever, retired Sunday. And Mike Missanelli announced abruptly on our sister station yesterday that he was done as of the end of, 2 days ago, at the end of May. And so he's off the air. And Angelo's going off at the end of December, and others are coming and going, and Jim Gardner will be off. And maybe the Phillies will win another game.
I'll tell you what, it's a lot of big institutional holes in local media and sports media, and it could also mean that hell is freezing over. Susan Baxter, I understand, is still recovering from COVID, so get well soon. Susan, we'll hope to have you back next week. Coming up today, big news on the opening of the Museum of Sports itself. Details, we hope, from the man himself, Dr. Nicholas Depatche Sr., and at 4:40, what's hot and what's not in memorabilia, with our own king of collectibles, whose family has the world's largest and most valuable sports memorabilia collection, who is also Nick Depatche Jr. But up first, it really goes without saying that the late Ed Snyder's commitment to hockey, both at the pro and the amateur and the junior levels, is beyond legendary. And it is why last night was the inaugural ceremony for the Ed Snyder Award for Commitment and Support of Amateur Hockey. It is a joint effort along with the Atlantic Amateur Hockey Association to recognize commitment to amateur hockey in the Delaware Valley. And here to tell us, you know, who won and why is a veritable who's who of hockey and sports notables. You see him down there with the 609 number, NHL replay official and USA hockey referee in chief with the Olympics to his credit. Mr. Jim Doyle is joining us today. Hiya, Jim.
Good afternoon. Great to be here.
And over there joining us, we've got all the basic food groups represented. We have New Jersey represented. We have Milan, Italy, with former Flyers executive for amateur hockey affairs and a friend of the sports show, Mr. Andy Abramson. How you doing, Andy?
Good, Doug. Hi, Lou. Hello from Milan, or I should say Buonanotte.
Wow. We're such an international show, Lou. Who knew? Certainly wasn't what I signed up for. And we hope to have him along here shortly. One of the very first recipients of the Snyder Award was longtime Philadelphia high school sports writer and editor. Don McKee will be joining us. So, Andy, start us off with kind of the big picture. I mean, talk a little bit about, you know, the Flyers and Ed Snyder's role in the origins of, you know, kind of amateur hockey in the Delaware Valley and the region. Because as you heard in that clip off the top of the show, yeah, having an NHL team is nice. Yeah, doing, you know, various youth programs isn't just to recruit, you know, players from college and high school and drill down to youth. But he said it's really about education and promoting more of kind of a mindset and a lifestyle almost.
Well, go way back. Ed Snyder was a hockey parent. Craig and Jay both played hockey at Lower Merion Episcopal Academy. Jay went on to play hockey at Penn when University of Pennsylvania actually had a varsity hockey program at the class 23 rank. So for starters, he was a hockey parent, and he was also a rink owner with Aaron Siegel. And with Lou, they owned the Radnor Rink out on Lancaster Avenue for many years. So, you know, he was involved in amateur hockey even before people thought of him being involved in amateur hockey. And then in 1976, the big picture, the big brainstorm that he and Aaron had was that in order to develop a future fan base for the Flyers, the easiest way would be to get kids playing hockey. Their parents become fans. They take their kids to games. The kids grow up. They become season ticket holders. So what we really did was had the very first ever fan development organization in sports. But it was more than that. It was also doing things that were true to the sport. And what came about last night was recognizing people, and we'll talk more about that, who made a difference and who really contributed to the growth of youth hockey, high school hockey, amateur hockey in the Delaware Valley.
Yeah. And Lou, I know, you know, we've talked about it at length that this was not a hockey town. It was not a hockey market. And that's what was the big risk about bringing in a franchise of any kind.
That is true. I had never seen a hockey game other than a minor league one at the old arena at 46 and Market. But Ed Snyder was such a visionary and so smart that we started the Flyers' first game October 1967, our home game. And 2 years later, Ed heard that the Radnor Rink in Radnor on Lancaster Avenue, as Andy said, was going to be sold and turned into a roller rink. And there was precious few ice in the Philadelphia area. So kids couldn't skate. There was only one or two rinks around, and there were private clubs other than the Radnor Rink. Yeah. So Ed Snyder and I and Aaron Siegel and another gentleman, Ross Turnbull, along with Ed, we bought it and kept hockey in Philadelphia for kids, and it was busy 24/7. And from there, Ed opened other rinks, and he was so smart. He knew they needed a pipeline.
And that was one of the key things that as I was looking for clips online, it always sort of drilled down to it was kind of an intake and an education and a retention sort of program. And Jim, I we've mentioned just briefly before the start of the show, you've got all sorts of great hockey credentials to your credit, including the Olympics, but none of that happens without some sort of amateur, you know, kind of grassroots programming out there.
That's exactly true. Even when you look at the area or the discipline that I'm in as an official, the development of the game at the grassroots levels provides opportunities for obviously coaches, players, and that other group that you need to actually conduct the game, which is officials. So in this marketplace, and I moved down here in 1982 from North Jersey, the Flyers had obviously just finished having success winning the Stanley Cups in the late 70s. Yeah. And the fan base here was tremendous. You could not get a ticket to get into the Spectrum. So the ability for the Flyers and Ed Snyder to build that amateur level hockey and the connection they had in this marketplace was really second to none. I mean, I grew up with, you know, watching or listening to the Rangers. When I came down here to the Philadelphia marketplace and realized the connection and the impact that Mr. Snyder had, it was incredible.
And talk to me, Andy, I don't know if you're the right guy I should direct this to, or Jim, talk to me about the genesis for this award. This last night's ceremony was the very first acknowledgement with your first ever class of recipients. What was it that you felt you needed to be recognized about that? And talk to me a little bit about the recipients.
Well, everyone recognizes that Ed Snyder was, as Lou said, a visionary. And having had the good fortune to work for him for 13 years and be around him for 15, back when the day with the Philadelphia Wings first, you get the sense that you want to recognize people who, in many ways, lived up to his vision of what was supposed to happen in the Delaware Valley. So Glenn Heffron, who's the Atlantic District Director and President, called me up one day and he said, you know, we're doing the McMullen Award in North Jersey and the Devils never did as much as the Flyers did, and we don't have an Ed Snyder Award. And I said, leave it with me and I'll get it done. And the first thought I had was I went to Lou. I said, how do I get in touch with one of the four original Snyder children? Because at the end, I've lost touch with them, you know, having moved out to the West Coast. Yeah. And I know Jay's somewhere in Malibu, but, you know, you lose touch with people after a while. And Lou said, let me get in touch with Craig. And within a day or so, Craig and I are exchanging emails. Love the idea. His sister, Lindy, who I worked with for 3 years, constantly trying to do things to keep Lindy on point with what we were doing with youth hockey. And she would come to our events and she was involved. So she was the right person to get into it. And Lindy said, I love the idea. This is great. Let's do this. Let's do that. And I said, Lindy, I just need your help. And she said, you got it. And we put together the program. We got in touch with Scott Tharp, a very, very successful Snyder hockey program. Scott jumped on board, put together a treatise of what the project would be, sent it around everybody. Everybody signed off on it, put out a press release, and that was it. And then we had to figure out who the winners were going to be, which was the hard part because it wasn't just about picking somebody. What's that?
Yeah, you wanted to have like a coach, a player, maybe an administrator. What were the categories you came up with?
Well, the good news was there are no categories. We said it was open to any person or corporation, paid or volunteer, who had started involved in hockey after Ed Snyder and Lou and the rest of the crew brought the Flyers to Philadelphia. So if you're involved prior to 1967, you weren't eligible. But anybody after 67 was, and we really went high and wanted to set the bar. And we had some nominations that, well, just didn't cut it. And, you know, Jim did a great job at sorting it all out in the committee, which Lindy Snyder was a part of, and Jim was on, I was on, Glenn Heffernan was on. We all basically looked at the list and said, we can do better. So we went back and came up with some really, you know, dug into the archives, so to speak, and the memory banks. And I made some nominations. Glenn and Jim made some nominations, and we agreed on who the final winners were. And, you know, Jim can talk about, Jim, why don't you talk about Ron Goodman? I'll talk about Scott and Don. You can talk about Bruce a little bit. And we'll fill everybody in because I think the people we chose, and Doug and Lou, unfortunately, two of them are no longer alive. But the emotion that was felt last night that I heard from people, Jim, why don't you tell the Ron Goodman and the Mrs. Goodman story? Because it brings a tear to my eye hearing it, because I knew Ron Goodman since 1981.
So one of the recipients last night was Ron Goodman, who's from Palmyra, Pennsylvania, right next to Hershey. And Ron has a son by the name of Bob, who played locally here in the Philadelphia marketplace for the Little Flyers. And Ron got involved at the youth level in terms of being an assistant, working with some of the midget camps. And as time progressed in the area where he works, he became involved with the district, the Atlantic Amateur Hockey Association. And Ron wound up for some 30-some-odd years being our vice president of suspension and appeals. So Ron had the opportunity to talk with and meet with and deal with parents, coaches, players, officials, over that 40-year period. And unfortunately, we lost Ron just this past March. He passed away. So when we reached out to his son, Bob, who's a doctor and an anesthesiologist and also works in the American Hockey League as a linesman, and let them know that he was going to be one of the recipients, they were overwhelmed. Last night, the entire family came out, Ron's wife, Mary, his brother Joe, his sister, and so forth. And I went over to say hello to Mary, and when she hugged me, excuse me here, she told me that yesterday on June 1st was their 65th wedding anniversary. Oh, and obviously it was the first time that the two of them hadn't been together. Yeah. But she was with her family and her hockey family that night. And she was not going to miss that event. So it was a really special and emotional event last night with her being there and her entire family accepting on his behalf. So that was a little bit of background about Ron Goodman.
To add a little bit more about Ron, I was the chief counselor of that midget camp, and he came out as a parent along with Dr. Price because they're two boys from part of the Hershey Midget Program. And the Doug Yinks was one of our key people in Hershey who ran the Hershey Bears for many years. He was the one who said, take these two kids, they're the best. And he was right. But Ron came up to me and he said, hey, look, I'm out here. Is there anything Dr. Doug Price and I can do to help? Whatever you need. I know you guys are shorthanded. You've got your hands full. You've got your counselor staff, but just lean on us. And that's the kind of guy Ron was. And that was a turning point. And I said, well, you know, we should get you involved more. And Bobby was playing with the little Flyers. And it all started there. Why don't you talk about Bruce Craig? Because Bruce was an asset. And I'll fill in the gaps on some of the things that Bruce was involved in that today still exist.
Right. So Bruce Craig, when I reached out to him just about 10 days ago before the event, was just flabbergasted that someone would remember what was happened some 30 some odd 40 years ago. And Bruce's background as a player and certainly as a coach in the Philadelphia area with the different organizations that he was with helped advance youth hockey in the Delaware Valley. He was part of the Pepsi shootout process, and where he spent most of his time was developing coaches in the Philadelphia and the Atlantic District. He worked with former Atlantic District President Jim Plunkett in the development of the coaching program for USA Hockey in Atlantic District. So many, many coaches over the years had been trained, supervised, mentored by Bruce Craig throughout his time frame in the late 70s and early 80s in the Philadelphia marketplace. And it was actually a pleasure to get reacquainted with him last night after all these years. He was absolutely ecstatic. He and his wife Sue were there. And it just was a marvelous opportunity for these individuals that contributed over so many years to reconnect with some of the younger coaches and players that they had seen and worked with in the late 70s and early 80s.
To add to that, Bruce was coaching at Wissahickon in the 70s. He started coaching somebody by the name of Mike Richter. Now, those of you who are longtime hockey fans will recognize that Mike Richter not only played for Germantown Academy, where Bruce also coached him, for the Little Flyers, the Junior Flyers, that Bruce also coached him. But then he went on and played for the U.S. Junior National Team. He went on to play for the U.S. Olympic Team. He played 4 years varsity at University of Wisconsin, and then went on to play for the New York Rangers. Bruce was responsible for molding Mike. Mike was a natural talent. Mike worked real hard, but Bruce molded him and kept Mike in check and gave Mike a lot of opportunities. But Bruce's biggest contribution is what exists today. So back in 1984, I asked Bruce to become our head coach for youth hockey for Hockey Central for the Flyers because we were starting some programs with the City of Philadelphia ice rinks, Cobbs Creek Park, which is now called Mrs. Sims Rink, Tarkin, Scanlon, Rizzo Rink. And I asked Bruce to take the lead in putting the program together so we could teach kids how to play who had never been on the ice before. And Bruce architected that program. And what you have today under Snyder Hockey are the grandchild of that program, albeit with a lot of more money behind it than we had. But Bruce put that whole program together, Doug and Lou.
Yeah. And Andy, talk a little bit about the posthumous award to Scott Chamness.
Okay, well, this is a tough one because what people didn't realize is Scott was like a little brother to me. He was only 3 years younger because I was starting at 16. So he was playing at 14. I was 16, 17 years old. And he was a total dominating hockey player from the time he stepped on the ice. He's an all-around athlete. He was like the second or third athlete of the week that Don McKee chose when he was a player at Archbishop Carroll. In every year, he was an athlete of the week. Second or third year of high school, he went out and played football. And just like in hockey, he was all area. And then the final year, he goes out and plays baseball. And he was all area because he was a natural athlete. But in hockey, he played so well, 271 goals in 4 seasons. Numerous games where he scored 10 goals. One where he scored 13, and I'll never forget. He was all upset that a kid named Eric Matzinger from William Tennant was named Athlete of the Week. And Scott was a junior at Archbishop Carroll. And he said, Andy, what the blank do I have to do to get named Athlete of the Week? I just scored 10 goals. And I looked at him, I said, Scott, you scored 10 goals against Methacton. I could score against that goalie, and I can't even skate. He goes, well, what do I have to do? I said, well, you're playing Unionville tomorrow night. Go get 13. So what does he do? He goes out and gets 13. So I then had to lobby Don to make Scott the Athlete of the Week, which he did. But going forward, Scott became the very first ever MVP of the Flyers Cup in 1980, the Bobby Clark Award. And that same year, for that 13-goal performance a year earlier, he was written up in Sports Illustrated, which put Philadelphia high school hockey on the map. And then that year, after winning the Bobby Clark Award, he gets named Athlete of the Year by both the Philadelphia Inquirer and Philadelphia Magazine, and then goes off to St. Lawrence to play hockey and came back and was tragically killed. So as I was explaining to his brother, Phil, when we were telling him that, you know, we needed the family to come to the banquet and the honor that was given to his brother, and Phil was very emotional. I said, Phil, Scott's going to have a hat trick. Flyers Cup MVP, Athlete of the Year, and now an Ed Snyder Award winner. And that's a record which I don't think will ever be broken.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful. And you mentioned Don's role in all of that. Don, we were hoping to get him in here. He's out there in the Zoom cyberspace somewhere. But Don really sort of mainstreamed high school sports and made it be taken seriously by a major market, you know, newspaper, and in many respects, probably by other media outlets as well. Andy,
without question, someone Lou will remember. Cy Roseman was the first executive director of Hockey Central in 1976. Ed recommended him to Aaron, and that meant I had to come along. And Cy picked up the phone. He said, "We need to get somebody named Athlete of the Week." And we picked Chris Gump Whiteside, who was Bill Whiteside's son, the labor lawyer around town from Fox Rothschild. And Gump was captaining Germantown Academy. He had a big game. He had a hat trick, a couple assists. He beat the number one team in the league. And this is 1976. I'll never forget. So Cy and I are on the speakerphone with Don, lobbying to make Gump the Athlete of the Week. And Don said, "You know what? High school hockey deserves coverage. All this PIAA stuff doesn't matter. Let's put it in the paper." And we had to get him a picture of Gump, and we did. And this is 76. I mean, getting a picture to the newspaper wasn't like, you know, just send it over by email. It went by IndyNet. I had to hand carry it down there.
Yeah.
And on a Thursday morning, lo and behold, there was Chris Whiteside's mug in the Philadelphia Inquirer, a nice write-up by Don. And all of a sudden, the high school hockey community realized that what the Flyers were doing with Hockey Central made a difference. And the news started to flow. Yeah. High school scores in the paper every morning. Daily news writing. I'll never forget. Ted Solari started to cover it because Don was covering it. You know, the papers were very competitive. And then Herm Rogel, I has to talk to him late at night.
They're not kidding when they say it's packed journalism. And I would guarantee you, you know, radio glommed on, TV glommed on. It really was like lighting a fuse. That's amazing.
Well, you mentioned Mike. You know, it was funny. You mentioned Mike Missanelli. And I remember when Mike was at Today's Post in the suburban papers, and they were already covering the high schools. But when Don broke the barrier with the Inquirer, that changed the whole complexion of how high school hockey was being perceived by the kids in school, because now all of a sudden the hockey players in the newspaper, not the football player or not the soccer player. So you know what that means for the kids. They're more popular. They become the big men on campus.
Yeah, exactly. Jim, before we go here, this sounds like it was a process, you know, both an emotional and a professional process for everybody involved. And I think you've really touched a lot of hearts in probably more ways than you imagined. And this is really, it sounds like, and I'm guess you guys are hoping and that it will be an institution, an annual institution.
Oh yes, absolutely. I think what we saw last night with the cooperation of the organization, the people that they had there, and this new award being presented, our game plan is to obviously follow through when the season starts to recognize these four individuals once again in front of hopefully the Flyer faithful at the Wells Fargo Center, and each and every year as they do with the New Jersey Devils, make this part of an annual celebration for those people who have contributed at the amateur level and or organizations, and be able to celebrate each year the accomplishments of what these people have done to help grow the sport of hockey in the Delaware Valley.
Fantastic. Well, NHL ref in chief Jim Doyle and former Flyers hockey exec for Amateur Hockey Affairs Andy Abramson, thank you so much for sort of letting us know how that first night went. And Don McKee, if you're out there, we'll get you on at some other point as we get closer to maybe year two of the awards. But guys, thank you so much. How can folks find out about this online? Is there a website up yet, Andy? Or
the Atlantic Amateur Hockey Association has a website, a Facebook page. They'll be putting video up in about a week of the whole event. Don was obviously very emotional. Phil Chamness, representing the Chamness family, was emotional. But it was a great night for recognizing amateur hockey. And Craig Snyder was there talking all about it. And Craig has ideas already on how to make it even bigger and better. So it's great to see that the Snyder legacy is going to continue with people like Craig and Lindy involved.
Fantastic. Guys, thank you so much. Come back anytime.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, Lou. Thank you, Lou, especially.
Thanks, guys. Hey, we want to make sure our viewers
will be here. Thank you.
We want to make sure our viewers and listeners go to themuseumofsports.org to make a tax-deductible contribution today, or better yet, buy a copy of Lou's new book, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flashing Cash Rescued the Flyers and Created Philadelphia's Greatest Showplace. A portion of the proceeds benefits the Museum of Sports, so you can be part of Philly Sports Shrine today. When we come back, the latest on the opening of the Museum of Sports and what's hot and what's not in the collectibles market when the Museum of Sports continues right here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. We'll be right back.
The Museum of Sports Show is presented by Depatchi Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas Depatchi is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat shortness of breath, brain fog, chronic disease, autonomic dysfunction syndrome, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Nicholas Depatchi, MD, FACC, at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034.
Who remembers the Philadelphia A's or the Warriors or the old arena at 46th and Market? We do, and that's why the Museum of Sports is being planned for Philadelphia. What's it like to face a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, ride your bike up the Maniunk Wall, or drive in the Pocono 500? We've got rare items from Babe Ruth, Mike Schmidt, Chuck Bednar, Bernie Perron, and Wilt Chamberlain. The Museum of Sports is on the air, and you can join the fun every Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. on WWDB 860.
It was 1967, and Philadelphia was in a rut. The economy, riots, Vietnam. That is, until the Broad Street Bullies rallied the region's spirits and brought more than 2 million into the streets to celebrate. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's candid memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You'll love the inside stories about Frank Sinatra, Ed Snyder, Bernie Perrant, Frank Rizzo, Elvis Presley, the 76ers, Mick Jagger, Electric Factory Concerts, and Kate Smith. And you'll find out how Lou Scheinfeld helped Ed Snyder rescue the Flyers and, against all odds, got the Spectrum built. Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed first edition copy at themuseumofsports.org. Themuseumofsports.org. The book the Philadelphia Inquirer called a fascinating and hilarious read. Blades, Bands, and Ballers. An ode to a building that truly rocked.
A nearly 100-year-old baseball jersey has broken an auction record. A Babe Ruth Road jersey fetched more than $5.6 million Saturday. That's the highest price ever for a piece of sports memorabilia.
Now we're back on the Museum of Sports Show here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live, brought to you by the Depatchi Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. I'm Doug Scheimel, along with Lou Scheinfeld. You heard that clip off the top there, Lou. That was from summer of 2019, was it? Yeah, it wasn't during the pandemic, so it had to be summer of 2019. A certain man is connecting right now. That was their sale, was it not?
I don't know. We'd have to ask the executives, the Pachi Jr. and Senior, and they're on with us right now.
Why, there's the power couple right there. My goodness, gentlemen, how are you?
Hey,
there you guys are right on time. This is wonderful. So, ladies and gentlemen. You know, of course, Nick DePaccia Jr., our king of sports collectibles. Well, that is the That is the man of the man of the collection to his left. That is Dr. Nicholas DePaccia Sr. And we didn't want to take you away too much from the practice because we know you have to make more money to buy more stuff. But I digress. Lou, I know you had some stuff for the good doctor.
Yeah, Doc, good to have you on. We've had you on in bits and starts in the past, but now we got maybe a whole 5 or 10 minutes together with you. And first of all, congratulations on having such a marvelous collection over the years. I know you started 30 years ago. You're originally a New Yorker, but you love Philadelphia sports. You have tickets to all the events here. You and your son and grandson go, and your wife, Marilyn. But you've been working on a fantastic project for a long time, and we just wanted to get an update on how things are going for the proposed museum in Washington Township. So some update you can give us and let us know where it stands.
All the blueprints have been completed, and they took months and months and months. We've designed a special set. We could put the high valuable high end things that people walk through, and then we can close it up at night and secure it. It's going to be a spectacular presentation. We're going to get the statues of Ollie and Fraser, the bronze ones we commissioned right in the front to commemorate the fight with their trunk. We'll have a whole section on Philadelphia sports, starting with the Philadelphia A's, Honor Society, the plaques that the old Philadelphia Historical Society had. We have them now, and goes all the way back to, you know, Eddie Plank and Chief Bender and Homeland Baker and all, right up to the 1950s with Chance. And we have all those. There's about 40 plaques of all those that were inducted, so people don't forget about the Philadelphia A's. Yep. We have a Philadelphia Warriors section, which are now the Golden State Warriors, who are going for a little dynasty run. We have that, and we have the modern sports teams in Philadelphia, along with great players and teams from other cities. But Philadelphia is definitely a fulcrum point.
And it's wonderful to have this because I know you've had various incarnations that have been sort of open to the public over the years, but this is really going to be the first sort of full scale, kind of full open sort of exhibit that you've had.
Oh yeah, this will be all encompassing. It's taken with the COVID has slowed us down 2 years or more, maybe a couple of years is slow. It's taken a long time. It's been a laborious process, but it will come together. I pray to God it'll be open before the end of the year. I'm really optimistic and hopeful, and I have very little time because of my clinical obligations. I'm putting as much time as I can into getting this thing to come to fruition.
Doc, it's Lou Scheinfeld. I want you to tell the fans out there about the marvelous statue that you commissioned of Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali in their fight of the century from Madison Square Garden. I guess it was 1971 when Joe put Ali down with that left hook. And that is a huge, gorgeous statue. And will that be at the museum?
Yes, it's a 7-foot bronze. It's a piece of art. Chris Collins trained with the best mentors, is a great sculptor, and he sculptured a lot of great pieces. And it's really not just a work of art, but a work of history. And it comes to life when you see it. And it makes you relive what many people consider the greatest sports event in the history of all time. And of course, we have the trunks from that fight each guy wore. And so that'll be the fulcrum point of the museum, really.
And you were a good friend and the doctor to Joe Frazier. And I know you helped him after he retired. And you have a bunch of Joe Frazier memorabilia, which kids today never saw Joe Frazier fight. They never saw Ali fight. And they don't know who Rocky Marciano was or Joe Walcott and Richie Ashburn. And these are names that thrilled millions of people, certainly me as I grew up. And I think it's fantastic that you're doing this. I know you have Babe Ruth stuff and Joe DiMaggio and Derek Jeter, and along with all the Flyers, the Phillies, the Sixers,
Carlin, Dr. J, all the bullies from Broad Street that you were good friends with. I mean, it is going to be a great representation of sports in this area and will be an educational treat for everyone from young to old. It will be very academic. It's called a sports library, very educational, and have a lot of meaning. So I just can't wait to launch it.
And that clip, I don't know if you could hear it off the top of the segment there, and I believe it was from Nick Jr. I think it was, because we've used the clip, I think, once before, back during summer of 2019 when the Babe Ruth jersey was sold. That was you guys, correct?
Yeah, we needed money to raise. We did sell an original Yankee one, but we did purchase a Brooklyn Dodger coach's one, full jersey. We do have his Yankee hat, his Yankee bats, some of his Yankee trophies. So we are replete with a lot of Babe Ruth memorabilia. I even have the trousers that he wore in 1932, and they're big trousers. So we still have plenty of Babe Ruth memorabilia, both what he wore and what he possessed. So it'll be nice to see.
And you've got Jackie Robinson material as well. Is that right?
Jerseys and trophies and autograph balls. Yeah, we have a lot of things. So stay tuned. I'm going to run now because I do have a few people waiting, but maybe next week I come on for another 5 or 10 minutes.
Absolutely. What is the weirdest thing before you go, Doc? What's the weirdest thing in your collection? Maybe something you didn't set out to get, but you're glad you got it.
About Johnny Unitas.
Oh, I told you.
Oh, wait a minute. Are those the bronzed jock strap? No. Is the bronze jock strap? Oh,
yes.
There we go. I know I didn't dream it somewhere. Not that would be very weird if I did dream about it, but you know what I'm saying.
The Museum of Sports Show. You never know what's gonna come up as a topic.
Yeah. It's verbal dysentery. That's all I know.
Well, there are odd things, and we've talked about some of them, like a jar of pickle juice from the Eagles.
Back
in the day, and famous quotes: Vic Waters, for who, for what, and Fred Shiro, win today, and we walk together forever, So, and you know what, I was very impressed, Nick. I don't know if you heard me say it a couple of weeks ago when you were talking about what horse racing memorabilia you have. And you had the blanket from which horse was it?
Seabiscuit.
And I recommended that you see the movie. Have you had a chance to see the movie yet?
Not yet, but I promise you that it will be done by the time the museum opens.
Well, that gives you some time. Okay. So what's been happening lately? Anything on the horizon of purchasing or looking for?
Well, personally, I went on a little card buying binge this weekend. So I focused on mostly rookie cards, quarterbacks, star basketball players. So I focused on Justin Herbert and Joe Burrow, Ja Morant. I never really haven't focused on it in a while. So I wanted to build up the collection, and some of them I'm going to hold long-term. Some of them I might flip, but we'll see. I tried to go after ones that are PSA graded. And you want to look for a grade of 10 or 9.
And Nick, for the uninitiated, explain what PSA stands for.
Oh, PSA, they're the company that grades the cards and other authentic memorabilia, the grade signatures, uniforms. So if it's in good shape, if it's in mint condition, it's a 9. If it's in perfect condition, it's a 10. And if it's even, I mean, if there's nothing that no flaws whatsoever, like it's almost like it came right off the factory machine, or the signature is like absolutely flawless, then they call it GEM 10. Obviously it goes down from there. It goes 9876543321 and
authentic. Lou would be a gem 10. Is that right? Lou would be a gem 10 or 9.
After I'm embalmed, if they don't crease my corners, I think I'll be worth something.
Well, they'll have you, you know, situated in the corner of the museum in an action pose, you know, grabbing or pointing authoritatively.
The Heisman trophy.
Hey, I want to take a quick break, Nick, and we'll come back. There's some stuff Lou and I want to get to you with here in just a second. But we'll be back here on the Museum of Sports Show on Talk 860 and Facebook Live back in a few minutes. Stay with us.
The Museum of Sports Show is presented by Depatche Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas Depatche is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat shortness of breath, brain fog, chronic disease, autonomic dysfunction syndrome, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Nicholas Depatche, MD, FACC, at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034.
Who remembers the Philadelphia A's or the Warriors or the old arena at 46th and Market? We do, and that's why the Museum of Sports is being planned for Philadelphia. What's it like to face a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, ride your bike up the Maniunk Wall, or drive in the Pocono 500? We've got rare items from Babe Ruth, Mike Schmidt, Chuck Bednar, Bernie Perron, and Wilt Chamberlain. The Museum of Sports is on the air, and you can join the fun every Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. on WWDB 860.
Can you imagine Philadelphia without the Broad Street Bullies or its fabled Spectrum Arena? Well, it almost happened until Lou Scheinfeld and Ed Snyder, otherwise known as Flash and Cash, teamed up to rescue the Flyers and got America's Showplace up and running. It was 1967, and the world was in a whole different place. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's heartfelt memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed copy at themuseumofsports.org. Themuseumofsports.org. Blades, Bands, and Ballers, now available.
Hey, buddy, what can I get you? How about the ultimate sports memorabilia basement?
Even though we've been talking to our king of sports collectibles, I'd like to play that clip.
I love that clip. That's clip.
It took me so damn long to find anything along those lines. It wasn't voiced by like a 12-year-old on, you know, some... blog or whatever on a podcast. Welcome back to the Museum of Sports Show on Talk 860 Facebook Live. I'm Doug Scheinmel along with Lou Scheinfeld. Museum of Sports Show brought to you by the Depatche Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. You see them there in the Zoom box. We've been chatting with them for a little bit. And Nick Depatche Jr., our king of sports collectibles, has been talking about some of his forays into some of the more recent rookie card markets. What has been, you mentioned a few of them, just remind our listeners some of the ones you guys were looking at and what's been happening to those values in a relatively short period of time.
Oh, yes. So the particularly young quarterbacks and basketball stars are really taking off, especially Justin Herbert, Joe Burrow, Ja Morant, even Trevor Lawrence, who had a subpar rookie year. He didn't live up to expectations, but people are speculating on his future success. Those guys in particular are really skyrocketing in price. Now you can still get really good cards under $300. You can even get cards under $10.
And who would those be for, though? I mean, are you just really just sort of throwing a dart at a board and guessing? Or what, if you had to recommend some at that level that you think are worth that money at that level?
No, Justin Herbert is definitely the best investment. Now, but you get into and it's the Prism, the base rookie of his. If it's autographed, I mean, it's even better. If it's in, now we were talking about grading. If it's in mint condition, 9, that's when the value starts to get in the hundreds. If it's a 10, then it's and grade it, like I said, a scale of authentic to 10, where authentic is the only thing below 1. That just means a signature or card is real, but it's like usually the older ones, many creases and corners bent, that would be authentic. But if it's a 10, then you start to get into like the 300, 400 range for just a guy like Justin Herbert.
Right.
If a GEM 10, like we said, GEM 10.
Like a low. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Then we start to get close to the 1,000 range. But if it's autographed and it's a GEM 10, if it's, and if it, now if we get to cards that are one of one or like they're refractors, they're like, they make them like chrome or something. And they make the cards a special edition. That's when you get to like the tens of thousands, but one, like the one of ones that are autographed and have a jersey. They call that RPA, rookie. RPA stands for rookie patch auto. So the a rookie card with the patch of the jersey and an autograph. If it's one of one, and it's Justin Herbert, we've seen them go for over 500,000.
Wow. Nicholas, how does somebody go about getting their cards rated? Where do you go? Or do you have to go to a card show? Or how does that work?
Yeah, card shows, they'll have graders there. Our friends at Golden Auctions, they have someone from the company PSA, which is they're the gold standard of the grading industry. They have them come once a month, I believe. And I mean, I'm sure if you went on an internet search and Googled PSA graders, like there's, you could find out locations you can go. But PSA's number one, then Beckett, I think it's BGA. Are the initials for Beckett. That's the second best. And the third best is, I believe, something called SGA or SCA, but I'm not entirely sure about that one. I try to focus on PSA because those are the most ones. Now there's other companies that grade like, but they're you might as well get what they call raw cards, which are ungraded if you don't get the top three companies that grade.
You mentioned that like obviously the older cards are you know creased or you know faded or what have you, and of course that was coming from generations where collectability was not the prime focus. You threw them in a shoebox was the old story. Maybe you got some sort of you know kind of scrapbooky kind of thing and put them in there, but that stuff, all of those old materials faded. Are you finding that people are taking much better care of these, and there are many more things out there that you can buy to store these cards in so they don't look like hell in, you know, 50, 75 years, 100 years?
Oh, yes. And especially when they're graded, they put it in a special hard case that protects it really well. But, yeah, these cards are, for the most part, especially the newer ones, they're getting preserved really well. Tens and especially gem tens are still hard to come by. But if you open them out of the pack, they should be at least an 8 coming out of the pack, the cards. And obviously over time, if they're handled too much, that's when it goes down from there. But it's, I mean, they're very, strict. They look at the corners, look at how the card is centered, the surface, if the surface feels smooth, they look at creases. So there's different areas that the graders look at. Some are tough, others. You might take it to PSA and then take it to Beckett and get two different grades.
Wide variances. But it seems like more people are taking better care than they did generations ago.
Oh, absolutely.
Like a Lou Scheinfeld, who would have an autographed set of Muhammad Ali boxing gloves that he hung in the sun in his beach house. And eventually the autograph just sort of faded away over time.
But when I hung it up, it was a cloudy day. I did not know the sun would come out over the next 10 years. So, yeah, that was. I now have two golden gloves from that fight in 1971, autographed, but they were. But they're blank now. So I have the gloves. So.
Good. We have that mistake, too. So you're not alone, Lou, and I'm sure many people have. I brought up once before, I have a poster of the 500 home run club from the 1990s when they did a show in Atlantic City with all the living members. And the most recent member at that time was Eddie Murray. And I have the poster. The signatures are in pretty good shape, but it's hanging in my room down at our shore house. And
it's always the shore house. Always.
And even though there's blinds in my room, the sunlight sneaks in there, and Willie Mays is pretty much non-existent. Looks like this, you can see him.
Yeah, but. Nicholas, let me ask you, Golden Auctions has branched out into other types of cards, wrestlers, movie stars, Pokemon. How exciting is that business?
Now my son's starting to collect Pokemon cards, but I mean, the ones he already has, that I have to teach him how to store them properly, put them in the binders, but I don't want to make him OCD like me or my dad. So I have to.
It may be genetic. You may have no choice.
Yeah. But yeah, the Pokemon cards, Yu-Gi-Oh is another one. But obviously wrestling and MMA, you brought up, MMA is huge. I haven't really gotten into that. Hockey is like, you know, baseball still is the
gold standard.
When it comes to the history of it, the old time cards, Mickey Mantle, 52 tops, the Honus Wagner T206 that we have, and we have but one of each of them. Ken Griffey Jr.'s Upper Deck rookie is one of them that's really gone up, but. Football and basketball right now for the newer players seem to be slightly ahead of baseball, but baseball in total is still the main focus of the card industry. But with football players, it's quarterbacks again. Like you want players that are going to be in the Hall of Fame that aren't going to be like footnotes in history, even if they're great players, even if they're guys that you love to watch that are perennial all-stars. It's all about the top few players in the sport and the premium positions. Those are the ones you want to go for. And you want to go after those insert cards, the ones that are numbered to 10, 25, 100, and the ones that are autographed, the ones that have jersey patches. Any card that's not what they call a base card. The base card are the ones that they have, you know, every box set when you get the full set, you can get the base cards. And that's what they like in the 1990s. Those are the ones that they really overproduced. Actually, the 80s and 90s, they call it the junk wax era.
Nicholas, I'm holding up a loose leaf book that my son and daughter had put together 25, 30 years ago of Pokemon cards and baseball players. And there are many pages in here, and these things are like at least 30 years old. And we just found it recently, and it was in a loose leaf book. For those of you watching on Facebook, that my son and daughter collected, and we're going to get these graded. I'm sure they're all gem. I mean, there's so many players from the 80s, 70s, and 80s, and some that go back even further. But probably, maybe it's junk. Maybe it's tens of thousands. But
you don't know. You just
I don't know, and I'm not going to tell the kids I found it.
Oh, the Pokemon cards, I mean, we're seeing go for big money, and I really haven't done much research on those or the Yu-Gi-Oh cards, but I mean, there's obviously a market for things you can't even imagine. So who knows what the next big thing's going to be? Maybe something like Sopranos cards or
No, you know, it's going to be pro tennis. That's the collective groaner, right?
That'll be the day.
I have, and I don't have them deployed here, but I have a couple of you know, encased in plastic, match used tennis balls, and I want to say one has a Federer and one has a Nadal autograph on them, and they're in the little plastic encasement, and I think it says there's something on it that says game used ball, and I think I might have paid $30 for that, $35 for that, probably 8 or 9 years ago. Assuming that wasn't sun bleached, because I had it in the windows of my previous place. would that appreciate at all, or is that kind of a dime a dozen sort of thing that they sell at the U.S. Open, which is where I go and get it?
I'd say it's more than, it's definitely worth more than 30. I would say it's in the hundreds, but I wouldn't say like thousands or tens of thousands. But I mean, if you bought it for 30 and say it's worth like 200, 250 or 300 even, and you get it 10 times what you paid for it, I mean, that's worth it.
Better than the kick in the shins, I always say.
Yeah, so I have a hockey stick from 1960 from the, I'm grabbing it right now, from when the Flyers won the first Stanley Cup, and it got a plaque on it on the blade, and it's autographed by the entire team. I'd say maybe 18 to 20 members of the Flyers Cup, and I should be handling it with kid gloves or white gloves.
It should
gloves.
Be encased in amber, frankly.
Yeah, this is Bob Kelly's stick. I don't know if it was actually used at that time.
Another classic Lou story, just, you know, yeah. Throwing the stuff in a pile or in the corner.
What do you think? What can you throw out a range of price on something like that?
Well, that's worth a good amount of money. And you said how many members? I mean, and I'm sure the prominent members of the team signed it too. Like Clark and Perrant and Barber. That's definitely up there. I would say maybe like between 1,000 and 1,500, somewhere in that range.
Okay. Better than my
maybe even more. Game used bats that are signed by the team, I'm more familiar with. But that could be that's definitely in the thousands. Let's put it that way.
Okay,
that's not bad, Lou. Hey, well, kids,
if your dad's museum would like to buy it from the Museum of Sports, consider it a donation. I'd be happy to give it to you guys on that basis.
And what is the plaque exactly?
The plaque is
hold that closer. I couldn't see it on the last one.
The plaque says, Philadelphia Flyers 1973-74 Stanley Cup champions defeated Boston 4-2.
That definitely adds to the value.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And the autographs are all, I'd say there's about 18 autographs on here.
Yeah. Including the.
Yeah, the big names. All the big names. Yeah.
Not that everyone didn't have a contribution. Everyone on the team had a contribution. I want to make it clear that I'm not.
Oh, no. You're talking about value to a collector. I understand. You're all about money.
All right, you two. Hey, we're out of time. No more negotiating. I want to thank our king of sports collectibles, Nick DePaccia Jr. As always, thanks for being on the Museum of Sports Show. We also want to thank all of our other guests, former Flyers exec Andy Abramson and Jim Doyle, NHL ref, Nicholas DePaccia Sr., the good doctor, and of course, our good friend Nick Jr. And don't forget to buy Lou's new book, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flash and Cash Rescued the Flyers and Created Philadelphia's greatest show place. And you can get an autographed copy of that from Lou by going to themuseumofsports.org. A portion of the proceeds benefits the museum, and it's available also where fine literature is sold. Museum of Sports Show brought to you by the DePaccia Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. For Lou Scheinfeld, a recovering from COVID, Susan Baxter, Nick DePaccia Jr., I'm Doug Scheimel, reminding you of what our good friend Carly Simon always says, Lewis.
These are the good old days.
Yes, they are. See you next week, everybody. Nick, thanks, man. Lewis, would you put that stuff in storage, please? Put it someplace where it's not going to fade anymore.